I'll take that back. I'm Trish. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 23rd, 1995. And, you know, I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And let me preface anything I'm going to say that I will never be able to adequately put into words what Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me. And if I start tearing up now, I'm in trouble. My life, you know, at the end of my drinking, the only solution I had was to pick up my toys and check out of this world. And besides giving me a way of living, my life is full of people that I cannot imagine not having in my life today. You know, my life has been so enriched by the men and women that have come in and out of my life, those that are in my life today, that I can never tell you all adequately what that means. We were laughing before we came because I said to a friend of mine, my story is very uneventful. I sent her a text that said, you know, I was born, it pissed me off. I drank, it worked, it quit working, I got sober, yay. You know, but I think Danny would probably go, holy crap, we can't stop. You can't do the Lord's Prayer yet, you know. But it really is. You know, I came from a family that loved me very much and who I loved them. I have four brothers and sisters who would have walked on water for me if I would have let them. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I spent most of my childhood, although my father was in broadcasting, we moved around quite often. But I spent a large majority of my childhood in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a red brick house on a red brick road with rose gardens in the backyard in a very, very Catholic neighborhood. I have four brothers and sisters. We were one of the smallest families. The family up the street had 11 kids. The people across the street had 9 kids. And I grew up in an era where kids would leave in the morning and wouldn't come home until the sun went down at night. And they had adventures, and they played in fields, and they played in creeks, and they climbed trees. And I wish I could tell you I did a lot of that, but my most favorite place was my closet. I absolutely loved my closet because in my closet, I also would put on music. I'd put on earphones, and in my closet, I could be anyone I wanted to be. And it was usually someone who had no siblings, who also had no parents. And I was somehow stoic, and I, you know, got through a lot of stuff. But from a very early age, life was, from my perspective, was very painful, was very difficult, and for some reason hurt so much. You know, I was one of those kids that, you know, I say I was very overly sensitive. If you made fun of me, you know, I wasn't going to let you know it, but if you made fun of someone else or hurt someone else, I would be the kid in tears. You know, if you laughed at a stranger, I would fall apart. You know, my mother used to say you were just, you know, that there was something about you that, you know, if other people hurt, you were just so devastated. And for whatever reason. And, you know, alcohol was not taboo in my family. My parents entertained, you know, quite a bit. They were married for 51 years until my father passed away a couple years ago of Alzheimer's. But alcohol wasn't taboo. And I, you know, as a kid, you know, I and so many people have shared that when I first got sober is I just never fit. When I first heard someone say they felt like they were always waiting for the mothership, I got it. Because I felt like I was always waiting for the mothership to take me to some other place, because where I was not where I was supposed to be. My youngest sister is several years younger than my other brothers and sisters, and she grew up at a time where Sesame Street came on. And why I still remember this is kind of freaky, but there was this little part of Sesame Street that said, one of these things is not like the other, one of these things just doesn't belong. And I used to sit at home thinking, if you put my family in there, they'd be able to pick me out. And so, you know, that was my, you know, being as a little kid. And I think really I was just a little kid waiting for someone to pour alcohol on me and take off from there. And but at the end of my seventh grade, or the beginning of my seventh grade year, my family was moving. They were moving from Pennsylvania to California. And my sister, who is 11 months older than I am, was the person I most idolized. And I wanted to be everything that she was because I knew I wasn't. She was talented. She was funny. She was pretty. The boys liked her. You know, I wanted everything that she had. And so when we moved to California, something had happened to her. And I didn't know what that was. But her whole being changed. And it was several years later that I found out that she had found the world of alcohol and drugs. And her life took a turn very drastically. And things started happening, you know, what happens to many of us. But, you know, bad things started happening to her. And so the focus of my family was on her. And I was fondly known as the wheel that didn't squeak. So no matter what was happening in my world, I wasn't going to let my family know. And the reality was I was probably, I was young. I was in elementary school when I made the conscious decision I wasn't going to let my family know how I felt. I really wasn't going to let anyone know how I felt. I couldn't tell you why, but I just did. And so when all of that was going on, California was a place I absolutely loved. I loved living there. I loved, you know, I had friends. It was just a wonderful place, and my folks were focusing on my sister. And that was good. And 6 weeks before the end of my eighth grade year, we decided to move again. And we were moving to Houston, Texas. And I knew my life was going to change. I knew I'd be riding a horse to school and dodging tumbleweed. And I really wasn't far off, let me tell you, when I got there. So coming from California to Houston, Texas, and we moved at the time where the boom was starting there. And the people born and raised in Texas were not fond of the people who weren't. The whole state of Texas was on my doorstep. I don't think they meant that, but I had a resentment against the entire state. I ended up in detention my very first day of school and for cussing and not saying yes, ma'am. So it was like, holy cow, what happened? But it was also... my father grabbed some kids off the street to be my friend, be my friends, and it was the first time I ever got drunk. And I've shared this in meetings before. I can tell you, you know, I was in a red Cadillac with white leather interior drinking slow gin. I was 15 years old, and my world changed. It absolutely changed, because for a brief moment, I was everything I knew I wasn't. I could, you know, I was outgoing, I was pretty, the boys liked me. I don't even know if there was boys around, but they did. And it was magic. I mean, it was absolute magic. And I couldn't get enough of it that very first time. And so I drank like I couldn't get enough of it. And I didn't know what happened when you drank too much, especially, you know, one of your very first times. So my friend stopped at a store. I think they were looking for something that had a consistency of a sponge to feed me. And so they came out with a box of Twinkies and started feeding me Twinkies and took me home. And I don't know if they stopped, but they let me out. And we had a long walk to the front door. And I've said this before when I've shared, you do that walk where you either stand up straight and it takes you forever to get anywhere because you just go from side to side. Or you tilt a little bit and it's like a ball rolling downhill. I mean, it does. It picks up speed. And I slammed into the front door and my mother answers the door and she just looks at me and says, "Can I get you some toast?" That's the only thing she ever said to me. So I went upstairs. I came downstairs the next morning. My father didn't say a word to me. Didn't say a word, just shook his head. And those of you who've heard me say this before too, that he had that look like my daughter learned her lesson, you know. And I did, because from that day to this day, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a Twinkie. But it never dawned on me not to do that again. Never dawned on me. And so I ran with a group of people who we would party before school, we would party at lunchtime, we would do, you know. But it was... If there were any consequences, I had an older sister who had bigger consequences. And so my consequences, it was like, oh, my God, we can't deal with you. So my sister was their focus needed to be on her. But during that time, it was probably 7 or 8 months after you know, goofing around with alcohol and some other things. I got involved in an organization that abstained from alcohol, abstained from drugs, and worshiped the man who founded this organization. And I got involved hook, line, and sinker. Every opportunity that I had, I went to this place. Every opportunity that I had, I spent time with these people. And my life was pretty much run by these individuals. And so I was getting ready to, and I didn't drink or do anything during this time. And so it lasted almost 2 years. And I decided that I was going to devote my life to this organization. And I was graduating from high school. The world of academia was not knocking on my door. I registered for my college entrance exam 4 times. I didn't show once. I fell asleep the second time, and my high score was 19. So no one was offering me a scholarship to go anywhere, and I really didn't have the academic skills to really be in school, much less in college. So, and I didn't believe I was a very bright person either, just from school and teachers and that type of thing. So I told my family was moving again. My older sister was getting married. She was almost 18, and she was getting married, and she was staying in Texas. And my family was moving to Connecticut, and I decided I was going to stay and devote my life. And I came home one day, and my mother had this very odd look on her face, and I followed her back to her bedroom. She started to cry, and she goes, "You've got to get out. You've just got to get out. You're in a cult. You've got to get out. You've got to do this." And my response was, "Okay," you know. And 2 weeks later, I was put on an airplane to New York. And my father had gotten me into a private university in New York. And so off I went and left Texas behind me. I wouldn't go back to Texas until a month before I got sober. And my sister lived there. And so it was years and years and years, because like I said, Texas was only 4 steps, before I'd go back to Texas, as well as leaving that type of environment. So when I got to New York, I met my roommate, and it was a very small university. There was 900 and some students, which were undergrads, grads, and law students. And there was a dorm and an administration building in the classroom, and there was a bar underneath the administration building. It was called the Rat Cellar. And so I spent the next year going from the dorm to the rat to classroom. And I'd be running to class with, a drink in my hand, you know. But the good news with that school is I did not have the skills to be in college. But I was afforded the opportunity to be tutored constantly on things like, you know, vocabulary 1,000 and reading and that type of thing, which was a gift. It really was. But the way I drank at 15 was the way I drank when I got to college. I took one drink and it tasted like another, and I would not stop until my body stopped, whatever that may look like. I decided after a year that I needed to expand my horizons, and so I transferred to a university with over 30,000 students in Michigan. And when I got to the campus, my father drove me there. He asked me, "What can I do?" The drinking age in Michigan was 21. I had come from an area where it was 18, and I said, "Take me to a liquor store," which he did, and we bought gallons of booze for the friends I was going to make. I don't know if I had any friends by the time we had to find someone who was 21. But the reality with college, you know, I had gone through college. I had a number of consequences in college as the result of my drinking. I ended up in the hospital a couple of times. Not because of running into things or hurting myself, but because of my anxiety and that type of thing. I can't tell you how many times I was told by the police to shut up or I was going to jail, because it apparently, when people got pulled over, I thought it was my job to tell the police what I thought, whether I knew you or not. I'd be walking down the street, I would see a police officer pull someone over, and I'd decide to go over and tell them what I thought, which was not productive at all. While I was in college, I knew in college that my drinking was not like my friends. I had had some times where my roommates would take the bottles out of my hand and pour them down the sink and say, "Stop." And I would think they just meant the night. And they didn't. But things were happening to me that weren't happening to them. There were many times that I had no idea, you know, what happened. And I'd end up somewhere or... And so the blackouts, and I didn't know what those were. I just thought I drank too much, which I did. But I thought it was also the stupid college tricks that people do when they're in college, because we all kind of did stupid stuff in college. I graduated from college. I moved back out east to Connecticut. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I got a degree in psychology. And I didn't know what to do with that degree. So part of my job was I was a store detective for Saks Fifth Avenue, which was a high-class peeping Tom. It had nothing to... And I would arrest people and then want to know why they were stealing, which did not go well with the company. So I decided, and in hindsight, when I had worked the steps, and I decided while I was in Connecticut that I wanted to go to law school. And I found, and through working the steps, I found out that the only reason I had made that decision is because just maybe if I had that type of career, I would mean something. And so I went to law school. Well, I didn't want to go to any other law school but in the law school, in the town where I went to college, because I wanted to go back there. So that's the only school I applied to, and I got into college. I mean, I got into law school. And my very first day of law school, I was the very first person to be called on. And I thought, what have I done? What have I done? I remember my first law book, the very first word in the first law book I opened up, I had to get a dictionary. Oh, dear God, what have I done? So I spent the next 3 years thinking, I'll never be an attorney. I'll never be good enough to be an attorney. At that point, I was working in the morning. I was going to law school at night, and I was drinking a fifth of gin a day. That's just what I did. And it just seemed to enable me to do what I needed to do. It enabled me to work and enabled me to go to school. When I was getting ready to graduate from law school, I knew I would never be a lawyer. I knew I wasn't going to pass. And the sad thing was, is that I graduated with high honors. I graduated sixth in my class, and I thought, there is no way I'm good enough to be a lawyer. I'm fast-forwarding all this, but I graduated from law school for a number of reasons. It was really to my parents were moving to Florida. All of my brothers and sisters, with the exception of my oldest sister, lived in Michigan. They had all ended up there over the course of years. My brothers went to college with me. We had a ball. And like I said, I adore my brothers and sisters. But my parents were moving, and it, for a number of reasons, I felt I needed to go for the benefit of my family down in Florida. And so I had been offered a job at the firm I had clerked with throughout law school, and gave that up and moved to Florida. And I was not very fond of moving to Florida, and my drinking took on a whole new, I don't even know what to call it. But, I was drinking every day. Even though I was drinking every day in Michigan, it didn't seem to have the effects that it was having. I took the bar down there. I got a job, and things somewhat tapered off. And I got a job on Marco Island. And I thought, I was driving to work going, I am working on an island. I am working on an island. I have arrived. And practicing law terrified me, absolutely terrified me. I would go to court, and I would vibrate. I'd be down on the island, and I would start drinking down there, and I would head on home, and there were times I had no idea how I got home. There were times where I would stop on the bridge, and I would have no idea which direction I was going. There were times where I'd be in the parking lot of the courthouse picking up car pieces because I would hit something on my way into court. But there really wasn't, I wasn't having, people weren't telling me at that time to stop. People weren't telling me it was a problem. And quite frankly, it was the only way I could think of getting through life. It had become where I couldn't imagine, not drinking was so uncomfortable. I couldn't imagine living life between drinks. That horrible restless, I didn't know that's what it was, restless, irritable, and discontentedness. But it was so difficult between drinks. And life had become so difficult. And there started that period of time where I would wake up in the morning and I would be devastated that I had woken up that morning. But I was doing the deal. I was going to work. I was on all outside, from all outside people looking in, I had my, the life by its tail. I was successful. I had an apartment, didn't have a house. But I was dying, and I was dying many years before I finally got sober. I left Marco Island, and I was working in Naples. And that's when the, you know, it started interfering with my work. I would come to work. I would learn how to take copious notes when I was talking to clients because I had no idea what they were saying. And I really couldn't function with it early in the morning. I worked in an environment that was fairly difficult. And I worked with some people who drank just like I did. I mean, at noon, we'd say, let's go out for a drink or two or ten. You know, and that's just what we would say, you know. But there was one time, a couple years before I got sober, my paralegal, I was coming down the hallway, and she grabbed me. And she said, promise me you won't drink today. And I didn't know whether to hit her or cry. And I said, yes. Of course not. I won't drink. Because there started being that time where every morning I would get up and say, I'm not going to drink today. I'm just, and it was with every fiber of my being, I wasn't going to drink today. And by a certain time that day, it's like, when am I going to start drinking? You know, when am I going to get it? How am I going to get it? You know, am I going to only have a couple? And most times I just wanted to be able to exhale. I always said that taking that first drink enabled me to exhale every single time. And I didn't realize once I took that drink, I was going to need another one, you know. And it was, and I found out here that I had a mind that was going to compel me to pick up a drink and a body that wasn't going to let me put it down once I did. I had no idea that's what was happening. But I also thought at that time that drinking was still my solution. And without drinking, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. But I also knew that I didn't think there was any solution. And so then became my second great obsession, which was, how was I going to kill myself? And so I thought about it all the time. I felt like, was it Harold Ahmad, you know, where Harold constantly tries to kill himself? I didn't. I constantly planned. And I planned because in the event I was not successful, I wanted to be able to do it again. And I didn't want to be a vegetable because I didn't want anyone to have to take care of me, and I want to be able to do it again. And so for months and months and months, I planned. And so there came, apparently, because this part of it was told to me, a time when I decided this was the night that I was going to end my life. And apparently my paralegal had called me, and I obviously said some things to her that resulted in her coming over. And she was frightened enough that at that time I had sought outside help. I had sought outside help probably 2 years prior to that. And I've spent an absolute fortune telling this woman my life was fine. And, you know, I would go drink before I'd go to therapy because I'd think maybe I'll talk to her if I drink. Not knowing that once I started drinking, all I could think of was getting out of there to continue to drink. So I had no idea that it was like, okay, we got to get out of here. I got to drink. And she had gone in my phone and called my therapist. And I apparently spoke to her. And then I threw my paralegal out of my home. And I passed out. And I came to pounding on my door. And it was my therapist and a strange person. And they came in. And I felt like all of a sudden I was a caged animal. And so I was on my floor going through my garbage looking for a drink. And they were trying to get me to leave to go to treatment. And they wouldn't leave my house, and I was quite upset, so I left. And I couldn't get the key. I got in my car, and I couldn't get the key in my ignition. And there was knocking on my door, and it was my therapist, and I didn't realize there was also a number of police officers with her. And so I got out of the car, and I went back upstairs, and the police had told me that I no longer had any more rights, that I was going to treatment, which I was not okay with that. And so for several hours, we apparently negotiated what I was. And I've been around enough, and I've seen sometimes what law enforcement can do with an intoxicated person. And sometimes it's not very pleasant, and they can be quite harsh. And I am forever grateful that these officers were not. As the evening went on, I assaulted a police officer. And so then I was told I was going to jail for battery on a police officer. And I wasn't okay with that either. And so apparently one of the officers at that time said, you know, I'll drive you to treatment if you go. We won't take you to jail. And it was several, I can't remember how much longer I ran into this police officer. I didn't know who she was, and she had come up to me and said, are you okay? And it was like sheer terror. It's like, oh, this is who you are. And someone had asked her, I don't know if it was a family member, is why they didn't take me to jail that night. And the police officer had told my family it was because she knew I needed help and that taking me to jail wouldn't have got me the help I needed. So the police drove me to treatment. And when they left, I demanded a court order to keep me there. And I remember hearing people saying, someone get a court order. And I took off down the hallway. I got to a payphone and I called a taxi. And I remember sitting outside this treatment center and the taxi pulled up and asked me if I was breaking out. And I was, and I said, you know, so I got in the, I said, okay, they don't have a court order. They can't keep me here. And really the only reason I went to treatment is I couldn't imagine appearing before the judge I appeared before on a regular basis the next day. That is the only reason I went, not because I thought it was a good idea. So I left treatment. I got the cab driver to take me home. So I say my stint in treatment was maybe 10 minutes. And I remember getting home and laying on my bed and thinking, if they don't know I'm here, they won't come back. And then my phone rings. I'm like, hello? You know? I thought, really? You know? So the treatment facility had called my family, and they were like, oh, you know. And so they came down and sat with me. And the next morning, I called my therapist and I said, I don't know what to do. And she goes, I cannot help you. There's only one place that can help you, and that's the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she had called someone to meet me at a meeting. And so I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't remember a thing that was said. This woman had met me. I sat in this meeting. I remember just holding myself and looking at my shoes. I remember one gentleman, I got sober in Naples, Florida, and his name was Coach. And he had these wacky hats. This one had a propeller on it. And he's the only person I remember of my first meeting. But the miracle happened at my first meeting because I came back to my second. I don't remember a thing that was said. The woman gave me, a book. It wasn't the big book. I bought the big book in the 12 and 12 at that time because she told me I needed to, because I wouldn't have. And she gave me a meditation book that probably 5 years later I opened. And it said, you know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And who knew, though? Who knew? So my family didn't want me staying alone, really. So I stayed with my family over the weekend, and I went to my second meeting. And it was at this clubhouse called the 24-Hour Club in Naples, Florida. And I drove in. It was a Saturday morning, and I pulled up, and there was one car. And a man got out of his car, and I said, is this a man's meeting? I mean, it's like, just you and I. It's like, is this a man's meeting? And at that time, a woman pulled up, and he said, I want you to meet someone. And this woman walked up to me and reached out her hand and said, welcome. And I burst into tears. And I said, I don't want to be here. And I just started to cry, and she's like, that's okay. You know, she's like, are you coming in? I'm like, yeah. And this woman's name was Jan. And, you know, so I went to my second meeting. Can't tell you what happened in my second meeting, but I listened to this woman at my second meeting, and she said things that made me, you know, feel like, God, she knows me. She knows about me emotionally. Not, you know, if I started comparing the way I drank with other people, I would have compared myself right out of the rooms. But I started right on the get-go identifying with the people in the rooms. And so I would sit in this meeting. It was a smoker's meeting, so half the time you couldn't see across the room because there was so much smoke. So I started smoking. because I did smoke beforehand, and I had quit, and it was like, if I don't do something, I'm going to drink. So my parents went and bought me cigarettes. Because it's like, please, smoke. So I'd go to this meeting, and I would sit there, and Jan would go around the room hugging people. And I used to think, oh, dear God, don't let her get to me. Oh, dear God, don't let her get to me. Oh, dear God, don't let her get to me. Oh, please let her get to me. You know, because it was just one of those, you know. And So after about a week, every meeting was my last meeting. I wasn't coming back. And I would leave the meeting and I would go to the liquor store and I would look at the liquor. And I'd think, I'm going to drink. And then I'd leave. And it was always the same woman who worked there. And I thought, you know, she probably was thinking, here comes the crazy lady. He's going to look at the booze and leave. And about a weekend on July 22nd, it's my brother's birthday, so I blame him. I had had enough. My family was calling me 24 hours a day. They were calling me at every, are you okay? One of my brothers had called me at that time and said, can I just come? He was living in Michigan. I was living in Florida. And he goes, I just want to come sit with you. You don't have to talk to me. You don't have to. I just want to be with you. And it was like, no, you're not coming. And so this was my other brother who, this was probably the 10th call that day. Are you okay? And I had it. So I ran out and I picked up a bottle, and I was running upstairs and I was ripping, you know, open the bottle, and I thought, well, I'm not going to drink out of the bottle, I'm going to drink out of the cup, because, you know. And so I poured 16 ounces, I guzzed it down, and I didn't even realize at that time what I said is, God, I can't do this. And I poured the rest down the sink. And I didn't know that the miracle had happened at that time. It was only in hindsight. So I went back to a meeting the next day. I think I was 9 months sober when someone gave me a white chip, because God forbid I stand up in front of the room of people, because they're going to watch me. They're going to watch me walk up. They're going to watch me walk down. And I just, that was just way too much. And so I kept coming around, and I was going to the 5:30 meeting. It met every day. And finally, after about 30 days without a drink, I was coming out of my skin. And so I went up to Jan, who was the woman I met at my first meeting, second meeting, and I asked her, you know, do you think maybe kind of, sort of, would you think about being my sponsor? And she said to me, are you willing to go to any length? And I intuitively knew the answer must be yes. So I said yes. I had no idea what she was going to ask me to do. And I started this magnificent journey. You know, I always say that the first step was my experience, that I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew my life was a mess, and that's all I knew. When I first looked at the steps on the wall, I wasn't going to do any step that required me to talk to another human being, and I wasn't going to do any step that had the word God in it, which meant that left me with step one, which was probably a very good place to start. So we started this, and Jan would say, you're on the first half of the first step. I'm like, you know, and so we started. And so she would tell me to do things, and I would do them. And I, believe me, any willingness I had was grace, because left to my own devices, I would have thought of a reason why not to do it. And so we got to the second step, and I thought, I'm going to drink because I don't believe in anything. And I was so worried that I was going to drink. And I remember I had gone to a 12-step weekend retreat, and I was maybe 90 days sober. And I was sitting on the breakers of looking out onto the Gulf and thinking, I'm going to drink. Because if I don't come to believe in something, and I knew people weren't talking about doorknobs, you know, that you believed in doorknobs that were keeping you sober, or, you know, that anything can be your higher power. But I knew you guys had something, that you believed in something. And I wanted that, but I didn't think that I was either not capable or just it wouldn't happen in my life. So I was at the last meeting of the weekend, which was God as You Understood Him, and it was being led by a priest who was in recovery. And during that meeting, I started to cry again, uncontrollably. And the priest, and there was probably 100 and some people in this thing, and the priest saw me crying, and he came up to me and said to the woman sitting behind me, put your arms on her shoulders. Put your hands on her shoulders. And he came up to me and says, turn off the left side of your brain. Now, I have no idea what that meant. So I was like, okay. And he said, just say something about God. And without even thinking, I said, he got me here. And at that moment, there was a huge clap of thunder. And he looked at me and he goes, your life has forever just changed. And so at that moment, I had come to believe in something, but I had no idea what I was going to do with that. And so Jan looked at me and she goes, I want you to take it the third step, you know, and I'm like, huh, you know, and she's like, and I want you to pray with me. And I'm like, huh, you know, like, oh God, you're pushing it. And so we did. We got on our knees. We said the third step prayer. And all I knew at that time is that I was willing to move forward with the steps. That's all I knew. I said it because I was told to say it by this woman who I trusted, I believed, that I heard enough of her story to believe that she felt exactly the way I did, and she no longer felt that way anymore. And she was sober. She was at that time 5 years sober. And so I did it. And she gave me a pad and a pen. She gave it to me because she knew if I she told me to go out and buy a pad and a pen, I would have to find the perfect pad and the perfect pen to start my four step. And so she gave me the pad and she gave me the pen and she gave me the directions. And so I wrote the book, and then it came. Yeah, it was a book. It was pages of my all importance. And so it came time to share my book with someone, and I was terrified. I was terrified. And so Jan met me at my home, and for 2 days, we did my fifth step. And I wish I could tell you at that time I saw my part in things. I didn't. I just spilled. It was like blah. And then I went on sabbatical from taking the steps because I had done enough. And I was crazy. And when I found myself with a razor blade in my hand and hacking at my wrists, I knew that I was in trouble. And I remember Jan saying to me, you know, don't spit in God's face, which was like, oh, that's kind of tough, you know. It was years later that she said to me, at that time I didn't know whether to take you to treatment or what to do because I was crazy. And so I got back into the steps. And so, you know, I took a look at the things, you know, and I even at that point I didn't know the things, my character defects. I didn't know the things that I was doing to hurt me. But I made a list of the people I had harmed, and I started making amends to those individuals. And in that time, she had me start reading the 10th and 11th step out of the big book. And so I was reading that every day and every night, and I started to search. I started to really search for a God that I could rely upon. So I started reading books that were feeding my spirit. I started going to listen to spiritual people speak. I started going to various churches. I went and saw, Deepak Chopra and, the guy who wrote, The Messengers. And I just went and started absorbing everything. Not that I believed in everything, but I needed to find a God that I could rely on. Because I knew in my heart of heart that that was the only thing that was going to change my life. I may not have intellectually known that, but I knew it in my being that if I didn't develop a relationship with something, whether I called it God or Allah or anything, that something greater than myself, that maybe my life would change. And slow by slow, it began to change. And so I went back through the steps again, and this time, and I did another inventory, and this time I got to see my part. And I knew at that time that if I saw that I had a part in everything that went on in my life, good, bad, and indifferent, that I could help, ask for help to do it differently. And so I started to do that, and my life began to change. I left the job. I had was working in a private law firm doing commercial litigation and bankruptcy. I hated it, hated it. And so I decided I hated practicing law. So I walked in and resigned without a job and said, I'm done. And so I left that firm, and sitting at home, I thought, what do you do with a law degree if you don't practice law? And a friend of mine called me and said, they're looking for an attorney for the state, who does for child welfare. And so I went and interviewed. I was offered the job. It was significantly less than I was making. I knew I couldn't pay my mortgage on, this income. And I was devastated because I honestly thought that that's what I was supposed to be doing. And so I called Jan, and Jan had said, write it down, put it in your God box, and get the hell out of your house. So I did, because I listened to what she said. And I went to a meeting, and the meeting that night was on leaps of faith. So I decided that's what I was supposed to do. And I got home, and there was a message on my answer machine from my father, who said, this is what I think you need to be doing. And if you need any help, I will help you. And I never had to ask. And so it started my career as a child welfare attorney, and I absolutely loved it, And I had been doing it for several years, and my father got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And at that time, my youngest sister, who couldn't have children, had her first child through an egg donation. And so I came up and met my niece. I had eight other nieces and nephews. She was born in November. I came up in December, and I fell head over heels in love with my niece. And so I went back to Florida, and I said I was leaving, and I was going to move to Georgia. Because I also didn't want to look back in hindsight and say I wish I had been there for my dad, and regret that I hadn't been here. Holy cow. Thank God I have Kleenex. And so I decided to move when the economy started tanking. And so I put my house on the market in January of 2007, and the economy was bombing at that time. Over 1,000 homes in my area went on the market at that time. My first offer came within 15 days of me putting my house on the market. I panicked. I'm not quite ready to go yet. Luckily, that fell through, and I really wanted to move in July, and my second offer came in May. No one else was selling, and it was like a hot knife through butter. It just went smoothly, and so I was working. You know, I had accumulated enough time that they were paying me, you know, part of my vacation time. I had 3 months where I didn't have to work, and I didn't want to take a bar. I had taken the bar in Michigan. I had taken the bar in Georgia. I was never taking another bar. I'm not going to do it. So I was going to move here and do something else. And so I thought, well, just submit your application just in case you change your mind. And I got a phone call from the Georgia bar that said, you are admitted in Michigan, never practiced in Michigan. My license had been suspended in Michigan because I didn't pay dues. And they said, you're admitted in Michigan, and we have reciprocity with Michigan, so you don't have to take the Georgia bar if you reinstate your license, which I did. And so I never had to take the bar, and I moved up here. And got a job in a law firm that is contracted with the state to provide child welfare. They weren't looking. I thought I had seen an ad on a site that said they were looking. Apparently they weren't. And so I had contacted them. They were just getting ready to put in an ad, but they hadn't put in an ad in anywhere. And I contacted a firm in Canton, and they're like, yeah, start. But the one thing with moving from, I was 11 years sober when I moved here, and I got this, you know, I don't have to go to as many meetings, you know, I got very involved in my career, and I was still connected to my sponsor, Jan. I was talking to her every couple of weeks, and let me tell you, I truly believe that my first sponsor, and Jan was my sponsor for 15 years, was put in my life so I could find God. She was one of the most spiritual people I've ever met. And she loved me so very much. And she was probably one of the first people I believed loved me. So I was still in contact with her up here. And so I really wasn't reaching out to anyone. However, in 2009, September of 2009, I found out I had cancer. When I first found out, my first response, and I'm so forever grateful, was, God, take my hand and walk me through this, because I got this, no big deal. And the news kept on getting worse and worse and worse as to what the circumstances were. And I found out it was terminal at that time. And I still thought, God, take my hand and walk me through this. But as things started going downhill, I was given the opportunity for a treatment that 7% go into spontaneous remission, and I thought, great odds. I mean, really? It never even dawned on me I wouldn't. And it failed. It didn't work. And at that time, there was a whole lot of other stuff that was going on. With my family, with my father, and things were going downhill for him. My illness started, things were not going the way I wanted them to. So as the news was getting worse and worse, and one treatment was failing and then another treatment, my relationship with the God of my understanding started changing from my perspective. And it says in our literature, there comes a time where we can't or won't pray. And I'm paraphrasing that. And I had reached that place. And the fear of what was going to happen in my life was growing. And the fear of what was going to happen in my family's life was growing, and the fear of losing my father was growing. And my prayer started being, God, where are you in all of this? And a friend of mine had handed me the footprints, you know, about God carrying you when you can't. And I didn't believe that at that time. And so it was a very, I call it the dark days of recovery, because it was a very dark time. And almost a year to the date, Jan called me and said she had cancer. And I was doing the traditional path, and she was doing the spiritual path. And I am so grateful for what she got to experience. And hers was stage four as well. And shortly, gosh, 2.5 years ago, she called me. And she had said, I'm not going to survive this, that I only have about a week to live. And let me tell you, you know, that woman taught me more about dying with dignity and grace than anyone has ever. And I'll never forget, a few days before she died, she called me. And she said, let me give you some antidotes in case this happens to you, you know, about your skin getting, you know, bad and this and that. She goes, do this and do that and do that. And I thought, oh, my God, you know. But she also called me. She goes, because I want to tell you what you mean to me. And I remember getting ready to hang up and said, I knew this was going to be a difficult phone call, but thank you for everything that you have done for me. And so when she passed away, I felt lost, even though I had a sponsor. I had a sponsor here, but I felt lost. And shortly before that, a friend of mine in the rooms knew I didn't have a connection here with a lot of people, and so she invited some women over to her house, so I would get to know them. And slow by slow, I got to meet these women who have. Once again, there have been women who have changed my life. They are so special to me, and they held my hand through so many things that have happened, you know, since 2009. Slow by slow, I got reconnected to my God, and I realized what was going on in my life had nothing to do with God, that my God is in the hugs of people. The people who said, I promise you it'll be okay no matter what happens. The people who showed up for my father's funeral, who were there when he passed away. What the heck? I don't cry that often. My friends know. You know, but what I have learned, you know, when I first got sober, it was all about not drinking. And it, you know, that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life was unmanageable, and the steps were about not drinking. And now it's about, you know, is whatever's going on in my life, is it making my life unmanageable? Am I powerless over the situation? Can I come to believe that there is a God that will restore me to some type of right thinking? Am I going to ask my God to do that? Am I going to take a look at what I'm doing, you know, and find out where my part is in it and ask for help to relieve me or to remove whatever is standing in my way of being helpful to you all, to God, that's creating problems in my life, you know? Am I going to make amends when I've hurt someone because of whatever is going on in my life? And am I going to continue to seek the God of my understanding? You know, and that's what it is today. You know, that's what I do today. My life, because I'm running out of time, you know, I still have cancer. That hasn't changed, but I've learned to live with it just like I do with my recovery. I now believe it's just a chronic illness, that, you know, a day at a time, we do what we need to do, you know. I always say, you know, my doctors have kept me alive long enough for another drug to come, you know, and another drug to come, and another drug to come. So that just may be my journey, you know. And I'm so very grateful for it. But to say that it wasn't difficult, I'd be lying. I mean, I really would, because there have been some difficult times in recovery. My life is full of wonderful individuals. You know, I sponsor women that have so enriched my life. And I've surrounded myself with incredible human beings, both men and women. I can't imagine life without Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jan used to always say, and so I'm taking it from her, that Alcoholics Anonymous will go on fine without me, but I won't go on fine without Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you all.